Okay, there's a story behind that. When I was living in Hong Kong, I was asked to go give a talk to the American school. Yeah, they have schools, international schools. So I went in and gave a talk in the auditorium, and one little boy raises his hand, and he says, "Can you bend spoons?" Yeah, and I knew what he was talking about because Uri Geller from Israel had been in the press a lot, and he had some ability to bend spoons. So he was wondering if I could do the same. And I said, "No, I can't. And in any case, I don't think the people who the spoons belong to would be very happy if I bent them." He looked a little disappointed. Yeah. You know how when you're a kid, you really hope that there's magic. Well, adults hope too, you know, that something can come without creating the causes. Impossible. Okay. And so let's generate our motivation and start by expanding our mind so that instead of focusing on what happened today, what we did, what we didn't do, what we liked, what we didn't like, to think long term, many lifetimes, however long it takes to accomplish the path. And so what we do in all those lifetimes is really important because that's what creates the cause for full awakening. We also need to expand our mind from only thinking about me, I, my, and mine. My happiness, my reputation, and my possessions, and so on. My way of doing things. And really think of all sentient beings. Everybody wants happiness. Everybody wants to be respected. Even bugs, they want others to recognize that, they want happiness and not suffering. They want to stay alive. They don't want to die. And so to relate to all sentient beings with respect and appreciation for their good qualities. And then with this big view in terms of time, in terms of sentient beings, even in terms of places, all the different places in the universe, in multi-universes where sentient beings live. So with this big kind of mind, then bodhicitta comes more easily. So generate that. So I've been working on a commentary on the King of Prayers, and And I think you've all read The King of Prayers. That talks pretty expansively, doesn't it? Yeah, that on every atom there are countless Buddhas surrounded by countless bodhisattvas. As far as we can, our eye can, well, further than our eye can see, because our eye can't see very far. Yeah. And, you know, infinite Buddhas, infinite sentient beings, that prayer just, you know, opens your mind to something so much broader than our mind is usually stuck in, which is, today, what do I have to do? It didn't go the way I wanted, or it went the way I wanted, or no, I didn't get finished, or, you know, whatever was going on. And how limited our mind usually is about what we think about. Yeah. And so that prayer is big. And, you know, when you really study that prayer and hear some teachings on it, then you start thinking, what would it be like, yeah, if instead of seeing everything the way I usually do, to see it as, you know, a compilation of atoms on which there are Buddhas surrounded by bodhisattvas. Yeah. Why not? Is there any harm to that? Yeah. And then, you know, when you read the prayer, you realize that Samantabhadra is actually talking about things that Arya Bodhisattvas can do. You know, they can look and see, you know, a myriad of Buddhas on each atom, yeah, teaching a whole lot of bodhisattvas. Yeah. So how is it that they gain these powers and these abilities to do that? Because it seems like that just doesn't fit in with my worldview about how things are, you know? And so how come, you know, Samantabhadra talks like this? Yeah, he's the author of, he's the one who spoke The King of Prayers. So when we start studying the super knowledges, which is our topic for tonight, then you see that there's some discussion of, you know, people who have very strong concentration, developing all sorts of powers that we don't have, that you can see if they're these powers are developed more. You know, they could turn into what Samantabhadra was talking about. Yeah, because it's so much, you know, because when His Holiness talks about the consciousness, he says the consciousness's ability is to perceive objects. Yeah, and what we're trying to do in spiritual practice is clear away all the impediments to seeing things. Yeah. And so he starts out, well, what's an impediment? I can't see what's on the other side of the wall. The wall is an impediment. Okay, so there's material things that are impediments. I can't see what's on the other side, or, you know, I can't see Spokane, yeah, right now, because of distance. It's too far away, you know. My mind can't see that. Yeah, my eye can't see that. So distance, time, you know, things that have ceased. We can't see things in the past. We can't, you know, have ideas, you know, realistic thoughts about what's going to happen in the future. The mind is obscured. And then, of course, karmic obscurations, that, you know, because of negative karma on our mind, then that, you know, puts us in situations where we can't perceive things, or it just limits our ability to perceive or to understand what we're seeing, what we're perceiving with our senses. What else? The afflictions, you know, the afflictive obscurations, the cognitive obscurations. So afflictive obscurations obscure us from seeing emptiness and from realizing nirvana, yeah. And cognitive obscurations interfere with us perceiving all phenomena that exist. Yeah, so there's a whole range of impediments to our perception, but the very nature of the mind is clear and knowing. So clear, it can reflect objects. Knowing or cognizant means it can grasp or understand objects. Yeah. So that's the nature of the mind, you know. It's there already. We just need to clear away the incredible amount of rubbish that's, you know, covering it. Okay. So as we talk about the super knowledges, be aware that, you know, actualizing these, you know, are steps in clearing away these different kinds of obscurations. Okay. So, we're on page 243 at the bottom. Yeah, the section is called The Super Knowledges. Okay, so the principal aim of the Buddha's teachings is to stop dukkha by stopping rebirth under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma, and to attain nirvana or full awakening. Okay, that's principal aim of Buddhism. That's it. One sentence. Yeah. Actualizing it? A little bit more. Nevertheless, the sutras present other spiritual accomplishments that are valued as well. So, nirvana, full awakening, is the principal one, but there's other accomplishments that the Buddha taught. So the first of these is mastery over the various dimensions of the mind, the dhyanas and the formless absorptions that are accomplished by means of samadhi. So that's what we went through the last few weeks, last few teachings, you know, how to do the preparations, to actualize the dhyanas, how to do the preparations or the access to gain the formless realm absorptions. Okay, so different dimensions of the mind. And it's accomplished by means of samadhi, single-pointedness. Scriptures frequently praise the peace and ease these mental states bring. So in the Pali tradition, yeah, you know, it's gaining this kind of concentration is praised a lot as a peaceful abiding in this life. Yeah, so it's kind of like, you know, we get tired, so what do? You know, we lie down and go to sleep and just space out. You know, what do people who have these kind of realizations and Aryas do? They, you know, to rest the mind, they go into these meditative absorptions and just stay there for a while. And when they come out, they're refreshed. Yeah, no nightmares, no, you know, difficulty falling asleep or anything like that. Okay. So that's the first one. Yeah, the other dimensions of the mind. So they were sought after and attained by many non-Buddhist spiritual seekers from the Buddha's time to the present. And also by Buddhist practitioners, yeah, both. But they're not limited to Buddhist practitioners, yeah. Another spiritual accomplishment praised in the scriptures is the super-knowledges. Yeah, what are they? Supernormal physical and mental powers through which meditators can perform feats that ordinary people consider miraculous or preternatural because they cannot be explained by either the science of old or modern-day science. Yeah, because science is dealing with the physical world. Yeah, and so what they're trying to understand is the external physical world and the biological beings in it and the chemical reactions in the physical world, okay? They aren't studying the mind. So the mind is a whole different realm of gaining understanding and perceptions, okay? And so we tend to say something is a miracle when it's a physical thing or, you know, usually. And we don't understand what the causes are. Yeah, so we think miracles happen without causes. That's not true. There's always causes. Things cannot arise without causes. That's just, you know, the nature of impermanent functioning things. If they arise due to causes, and as soon as they arise due to causes, since the causes are changing, then the result is constantly changing and giving way to future results. Okay. So, you know, science can't really understand this. We call it magic. So these special abilities are a byproduct of samadhi. Yeah, they're coming as a byproduct. The purpose of samadhi is to enter these, you know, states, and the byproduct is then you can use that samadhi to generate these super knowledges. The super knowledges, it sounds like, don't just pop up out of nowhere. Yeah, but there involves some training to do them. We'll get into that. Okay, so these special abilities are a byproduct of samadhi and give meditators access to hidden laws of the material world that can only be known through refined states of meditative absorption. Yeah, so what science does is wonderful, but it's also limited. Yeah? Okay. Like mastery of dimensions of the mind, the super knowledges can be attained by non-Buddhists as well as Buddhists. While some spiritual seekers hold them as the purpose of the path, the Buddha sees them as a byproduct of deep concentration. So with the non-Buddhists, and maybe even a few Buddhists here and there, you know, it's like, I want to get the super knowledges, I want these powers, I want to be special, whatever it is, okay. But, you know, so that's the purpose of what they're practicing. For the Buddhas, Buddhist path, they're the byproduct. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Buddha emphasized to his disciples that they should not be content with attaining the various meditative absorptions or supernormal abilities, because without the attainment of nirvana, they are still susceptible to all forms of samsaric dukkha. So you can have lots of clairvoyant psychic powers, yeah, but you're still in samsara. And when this life ends, you're going to be reborn according to whatever karma in your mind stream ripens. So having those powers or not having them, you know, they degenerate when you go through the death and rebirth process. Yeah, and you know, just because you have samadhi in this life doesn't mean you come out of the womb with samadhi in the next life. Yeah, if you come out as a human being, you still cry and you scream and, you know, like babies do. Yeah, I mean, what do they do when you're born? They turn you upside down, whack you on the bottom and wait for you to cry. And that indicates that, you know, you're breathing. So, okay. So the Buddha emphasized we shouldn't be content with attaining these high states of consciousness or with the supernormal abilities. Yeah. Because nirvana is our final goal, in which we actually are secure from dukkha. Yeah. Before that, there's no security from dukkha. For this reason, when the Buddhists cultivate these abilities, it is of the utmost importance to have a motivation to benefit others. Otherwise, they risk falling prey to conceit and clinging and will find themselves in unfortunate rebirths in future lives. Yeah, so as a Buddhist, you know, you have to have a motivation to help others, because otherwise, if it's just for this life, you know, I have special powers. You can come and consult me, and I'll give you a prediction of what's going to happen, or I'll tell you your karma from previous life, or whatever it is, okay? Then it's so easy to, you know, be conceited because you have some special power. And then, of course, when others start coming to you and making a fuss over you, then, wow, you know, you put out your Donna basket, or you make up a payment plan, and because people love this. I've told you before about, we went to, what was the name of that? Some kind of new age something. Anyway, it was years ago. And we went, and they had different booths, and people were doing, you know, all sorts of things, you know, putting things here to clear, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And we had like a little table, and on this side was one fortune teller. This side was the other one, you know, they were both psychics. Yeah. So people come along, and, you know, they're looking. So people would stop at the first psychic and, you know, tell me about my life, you know, the psychic, whatever they did. And, you know, and then told them something, you know. And they're listening so attentively. Wow, she's telling me about my life and who I'm going to meet and what I'm going to do. And it really sounds good, you know. And and then they would walk right past our table and go to the next psychic and pay the two psychics, you know. And what does this psychic say? You know, and then the whole process again. Now, why do people do this? Because the psychic gives you information about my life and me and what I can do and become, you know. And Buddha's, you know, the scriptures, Buddha's scriptures give you that information too in the form of karma and what is virtuous and what is non-virtuous. But it isn't, the format isn't the same. You know, you have to come and sit there and listen to a teaching and generate a good motivation. And, you know, you can't sit there like this in front of the psychic. You know. Okay. And also, you know, there's people who have some sort of psychic abilities for different things. And it doesn't mean that they've actualized nirvana. It doesn't mean that they have even attained the dhyanas or the formless realm absorptions. But sometimes these kind of powers come because of karma, you know. So somebody has a karma to see maybe some things in the future or the past or whatever. It's limited, you know, their psychic powers are limited because it's depending on karma, not the concentrated states. And so sometimes it can be erroneous too. Yeah. And then there's people who you haven't asked to for any kind of thing, but come in and say, well, I'm a psychic and, you know, I had one person, you know, your mom is in the Bardo. My mom had been had died several years before, so I think she was off into another life by then. But she said, your mom's in the Bardo. I talked to her. She said she loves you. I'm going, you know. Yeah, but, you know, she meant well. It was okay. You know, and then she told me something. I was going to have some problems with my throat. Yeah, well, you know, yeah, everybody has problems with their throat. Yeah, don't you have problems with your throat sometimes? You get hoarse, you get a sore throat. Yeah. So, yeah, so, you know, yes. Oh, yeah, then there was one guy. Yeah, Singapore, there's lots of people like this. Yeah, what was his thing? I forget now. But again, you know, I didn't ask for anything. He just started telling me. Okay. So it's very important if you cultivate these abilities to have a motivation to benefit others so you don't fall into conceit and into clinging, yeah, an attachment, so forth. Okay, and find yourself in unfortunate realms in the next life because you didn't create virtue, you know. For example, the Tibetans love this story. For example, a meditator in Tibet had deep concentration and could maintain the visualization of himself as the wrathful deity Yamantaka. Yeah, we have a path in the forest named after him because it's steep and it's difficult, you know. So Yamantaka is, you know, he has 9 heads, yeah. He's a buffalo, yeah. He's a buffalo head. 9 heads, what is it, 34 arms, 16 feet, 16 legs, yeah. And, you know, he's wearing a necklace made of dried skulls, and he has horns, you know, and yeah, and he's super showing the aspect of, you know. And so you do retreat on him, yeah. And of course, you know, you do the self-generation and imagine yourself looking like that. And it shows you your anger, yeah. But it also gives you an interesting way to direct your anger too. Okay, so this meditator could maintain a visualization of himself as the wrathful deity Yamantaka. But since he lacked the aspiration for liberation, he did not cultivate wisdom. And in his next rebirth, he was born as a spirit that looked like Yamantaka. So he was born as a spirit who had that wrathful appearance. Yeah. He was not the deity. Yeah, because he didn't have the same realizations as Yamantaka has. There is also a story of a novice who could fly. Since his determination to attain liberation was not strong, one day when he heard the enchanting singing of a maiden working in the fields below, he fell in love from hearing her sing. Yeah, is that what your relationship is based on? Okay, anyway, he heard the enchanting singing of a maiden working in the fields below. He fell in love and disrobed to marry her. Yeah, that's not such a good outcome, is it? On the other hand, practitioners who use supernormal powers with compassion to benefit others and to spread the Buddhist teachings enact great benefit. Okay, so what makes something valuable or not, as always, comes down to our motivation. Yeah, not what other people think about it afterwards. Although the Buddha taught these three aims, nirvana, mastery over dimensions of the mind, and the superknowledges, those are the three, he knew his followers had different aptitudes and interests and did not expect all of his disciples to accomplish the latter two. Yeah, the deep meditative states and the superknowledges. These arhats who attain nirvana but not the other two are called those liberated by only wisdom. Yeah. They attain liberation either by using the capable preparation, which is the preparatory stages to the first dhyana. Yeah. So they attain liberation even just not even having the first dhyana. Yeah. That the arhats can do that. Bodhisattvas cannot. Yeah, bodhisattvas cannot attain awakening with just that. Bodhisattvas have to actualize everything and be able to do everything. Yeah. But arhats, yeah, can they attain liberation either by using the capable preparation or by developing wisdom and eradicating defilements simply on the basis of access concentration. Okay, so here, yeah, access concentration has a few different ways it can be described. So unless otherwise mentioned, access concentration refers to the preparatory stages of the first dhyana. So that's comparable to the capable one. Okay. So they just, you know, those are the ones who are called the dry, wizened arhats, yeah, because they don't have their minds haven't been moistened, softened by deep states of concentration. Yeah. Okay. So those who attain arhats, yeah, who attain nirvana, as well as the four dhyanas, four formless absorptions, and perhaps even the cessation of discrimination and feeling, which we talked about last time, yeah, have mastery of a wide range of mental states and are called those liberated in both ways. Sometimes in the Pali scriptures, you find this expression, you know, liberated by mind, liberated by wisdom. Liberated by mind means that they have these deep states of concentration. Liberated by wisdom means that they've realized emptiness. Disciples who gain nirvana as well as mastery over mental states and the superknowledges are called arhats with the six superknowledges. In countries following the Pali tradition, they say that we find all three types of persons to this day. And when I was in Thailand, yeah, the monks told me that. In short, although the super knowledges are not a sign of insight or wisdom, Buddhist texts do consider them a sign of spiritual accomplishment. In the Buddhist time, many yogis had these abilities and would even challenge the Buddha to contests in miraculous powers. So they're considered spiritual accomplishments because these people worked hard, you know, in their meditation practice and so on to generate them. And they are accomplishments that, you know, ordinary people don't have. But they're not nirvana. Okay. So one of the four special Buddhist days in the Tibetan calendar, the full moon of the first lunar month, yeah, we celebrate that. It's usually in February, you know, around that time. Okay, so it celebrates the Buddha's victory in one such contest. After a group of non-Buddhist yogis kept prodding the Buddha to participate in such a contest, he reluctantly consented. His purpose was to subdue their arrogance, and by showing extraordinary, miraculous powers, he successfully did this, and they later became his disciples. Yeah, so he did not want to do this. They kept asking and asking, and the Buddha said, no, no, no. Because he saw, you know, just having a contest of supernormal powers, you know, so what? He didn't want to emphasize to people that this was the accomplishment of nirvana, or that this was what they should aim for, the principal thing to aim for in their practice. But these people just bugged him and bugged him and bugged him, you know, kind of like you hear how somebody says, can't we have coffee? Can't we have coffee? Can't we have coffee? You know, so they kept bugging him and bugging him. And then finally the Buddha said, okay. So they had this contest, and of course, you know, the Buddha's miraculous powers were far greater than those of these non-Buddhists. And so you see, you know, why did the Buddha consent to do that? Yeah, it wasn't just because he got tired of these guys nagging him. It was because he could do them, and by showing that his abilities were superior, they would see, oh, somebody has more accomplishment than us. We should follow his path. We should become his disciples. And so that was a skillful way to show those people, to follow the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma. Yeah, it was a skillful way to do it. So people always say, well, why don't the yogis do that now? Yeah, and, you know, couldn't you just imagine it? Yeah, and what's that big square in London, Trafalgar, some British name, yeah. Or in the big plaza in front of the Kremlin and the big Orthodox church in Moscow. Or, you know, couldn't you imagine one of these places totally jam-packed with people? Yeah. And then there's a Buddha who, you know, starts doing his magic powers, you know, showing them. Yeah. What are people going to do? What?
Get out their phones.
Yes, exactly. They'll get out their phones and they'll start filming him, you know. And then they'll say, you know, call CNN and, you know, call this one, call that one. And it would just be a mad craziness. And would any of them become the Buddha's disciples after that? Doubtful. They'd be too busy showing their videos that they took on their phones to all their friends and saying, I saw this. Of course, they didn't see it with their eyes. They saw it through a lens. Yeah. But like, I saw this. This was so far. Can you believe? And then you tell your children and you tell your grandchildren. And this gets passed down in the family. And then, you know, you become a family matriarch, patriarch, you know. Yeah. Okay, so the Buddha doesn't do that. To meet the expectations of society at that time, some of the Buddha's disciples accomplished supernormal powers. That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, they did it to meet the expectations of other people. Again, not for praise, but so that these other people would, who valued supernormal powers would think, oh, you know, the Buddha has them too, and follow the Buddha's teachings. Okay, to meet the expectations of society at that time, some of the Buddha's disciples accomplished supernormal powers, but the Buddha prohibited his followers from displaying these powers to show off. Okay, in fact, monastics who speak even truthfully about their supernormal powers transgress a pratimoksha precept. It's one of the lapses. Okay. So you can't even speak truthfully about, oh, I've actualized this, actualized that. Okay. Why? Because then everybody would just, you know, say, oh, do this, do that. You know, it just gets weird. Yeah. Yeah, there was one instance where there was one nun, there was some practice that I don't know if Rinpoche taught her or how she learned it, but she could see images. She would do a certain puja. You would ask her questions and she would do a puja, and she could, I think it was like a brass flat circle, something, you know, like a plate, and she could see images in that and then tell you things. And Lama Zopa encouraged her to do it. Yeah. And so she did it for a while, and then, you know, I think she must have stopped because I didn't hear any more about it or hear of her you know, doing that anymore. But at the beginning, you know, it's like everybody was lined up to have her tell them something about their life. Okay, so Buddha prohibited his followers from displaying these powers to show off. In fact, monastics who speak even truthfully about their supernormal powers transgress the pratimoksha precept. Those who lie about having powers they do not have commit a root offense. In other words, root offense, you lose your ordination. Basta, finito, you cannot ordain again in that life. Okay? And the story behind this, quite interesting, you know, some of these the origin stories of the precepts. So there was a famine in India, yeah. And so, of course, when there's a famine, people don't have very much to eat. So the dana they give to the monastics is very little because they don't have a lot, okay. So this was during the Varsa, I think. Yeah, and so they didn't, you know, the people and most of the monastics didn't have very much to eat. But there was a group of, maybe it was the six naughty monks, yeah. And they went to see the Buddha after Varsa. And the Buddha looks at them and says, oh, you guys look pretty well endowed, you know. You've been eating well during this famine. How did that happen? And they said, well, you know, we were hungry, and we knew that if we told people that we had different super knowledges, that they would respect that and give us more food. So we got more food that way, you know. They were kind of proud of their way of deceiving the public in order to get, you know, because the householders, they had such respect for people with these powers that rather than eat the food themselves, they would give, you know, more food to the mendicants. So when the Buddha heard this, yeah, you can imagine what the Buddha said. You know, he always started out with, "You fool." Yeah. And then he would go into this whole explanation about how, you know, doing that is not proper behavior for a monk, and it's damaging, and you create negative karma, and so on and so forth, and you must stop this. And then he, you know, made a precept, you know, and that's what why we, you know, the fourth root one is to not lie about spiritual attainments. And you can see how damaging that is. You know, you could say, well, it made me survive the famine. But then when the lay people see, are they going to respect that when they find out that you were just lying? No, they're going to lose faith in the Dharma. So, yeah. Okay, so those who lie about having powers they do not have commit a root offense. And these six naughty ones did not have the powers. Throughout the ages, the Buddha's disciples with these abilities have used them to work in unobtrusive ways to benefit others and to spread the Dharma. Unobtrusive ways. Yeah. So they don't say, okay, everybody, you know, I'm going to pull a rabbit out of the hat now. Look. Yeah, it didn't do that. Yeah, and so you never really know who has powers and who doesn't. When I was studying at the library with Geshe Nawang Dargi, Annie Karen, for those of you who know her, she was there, and she and I were good friends. And so we would often meet in the evenings and talk about the discourse that Geshe La gave that day. And where am I going with this? Oh, yes, and we would talk about what he said, and often we left the discussion with a question. Like, well, what does this really mean? What does that mean? How does that work? And then the next day in class, we didn't say anything. But he, just in the course of giving the teaching, answered our question. Yeah. So we started wondering about that, you know. Now, you don't know, you know, but it was interesting, yeah? Okay. A sutra tells the story about the layman, Kavada, who asked the Buddha to increase the faith of the lay people by demonstrating his supernormal abilities, but the Buddha refused. Kavada then asked him to display his ability to read others' minds, which the Buddha also declined. Instead, the Buddha showed Kavada another type of miracle. Okay, this is from the sutra. And what is the miracle of instruction? Here, Kavada, a monastic gives instructions as follows. Consider it this way. Don't consider it in that way. Direct your mind this way, not that way. Give up that, gain this, and persevere in it. In other words, the true miracle is being able to instruct others and inspire their faith in the Dharma so that they may be led away from dukkha and attain nirvana. That's the real miracle. Yeah. And so what's the miracle? When you say, look at things in this way. Yeah, don't look at them in that way. Yeah, if you look at them in that way, you're going to get confused and befuddled. If you look at things from this perspective, you can understand. Yeah. Consider it this way, don't consider it that way. Direct your mind this way, not that way. Yeah, direct your mind to virtue. What is virtuous? Do we even know when we start Dharma practice? Yeah, do we know what is virtuous and what's not virtuous? We know a little bit, you know, don't lie, don't kill, don't steal. We know the words, but do we know the why? Yeah. And, do we understand the why? Do we understand the effect on others and on ourselves when we act in a virtuous way? Do we understand the effects on others and ourselves when we engage in non-virtue? We're very often, you know, out to lunch, yeah? And so many questions when we start the unit on karma, which we didn't go into in depth when we did the volume 3, was it? Or volume 2? Anyway, when we did that, you know, His Holiness refers us to the Lam Rim books, you know, to learn that. But when you start reading about the details of these actions, and similarly with the details of keeping some of the precepts, then a lot of questions come in your mind. Well, what about this? What about that? Last week, when I was teaching about killing, the precept to abandon killing, so many questions came up, didn't they? Yeah. So it isn't like we automatically know what to practice and what to abandon. But, Buddha's saying that's the true miracle, being able to give people that kind of instructions because so they can direct their minds to virtue, direct their minds to non-virtue. Okay. And then give up that, gain this, and persevere in it. So here are the teachings. Practice them. Yeah, here are the signposts of what you'll understand and gain. And then continue practicing, continue developing those understandings. Okay, so the true miracle is being able to instruct others and develop their faith in the Dharma so that they may be led away from dukkha and attain nirvana. And that is a rare thing in life, in samsara, isn't it? It is rare like miracles are rare. In fact, probably more rabbits come out of hats than, you know, people get instructions about this. When used with a good motivation, such as to attain liberation or awakening, or to benefit sentient beings with great compassion, these powers allow us to accumulate merit and generate wisdom quickly. How did they do that? They enable bodhisattvas to benefit sentient beings easily and exactly according to their needs. Wow. You know, if you know the past lives and the karma of people in the past, if you know their present disposition and way of thinking, wow, then you can really, instruct them according to what they need to hear at that specific time. Yeah. And so often we're just like, what do they say, stabbing in the dark? I'd like to come up with another metaphor for that. Yeah. Maybe stumbling in the dark. Yeah. Okay. And so, bodhisattvas can really benefit sentient beings that way, teaching them exactly what they need. And they say one of the abilities of the Buddhist speech, which comes from his great accumulation of merit, is that everybody in the audience hears it in their own language. And everybody hears it as a personal instruction that applies to what's in their mind right now. Okay. So the first five superknowledges, there's six of them. So the first five are mundane abilities. Mundane meaning that you don't have to have, be an arhat or a Buddha or highly realized for having them. Okay, so these are supernormal powers. It's the first one, divine ear. Second, third, understanding the minds of others. Fourth, recollection of past lives. And fifth, the divine eye. Okay, the sixth superknowledge is a supermundane realization, the destruction of the pollutants. So somebody, supermundane, it's an arya, a realization of an arya. And so an arya can tell, they know what afflictions and degree of those afflictions they have been able to abandon completely, not just suppress with concentration, but to abandon. And when you if you practice the Sutrayana path, there's 89 groups of afflictions, and no, 81 groups of afflictions, and arhats or aryas will know which groups they have abandoned and which they have yet to abandon. So while non-Buddhists may actualize the first five because they're mundane, you don't have to be an arya, only Buddhists who seek liberation from samsara seek the sixth one, the attainment of liberation. The last three superknowledges, recollection of past lives, divine eye, which is knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings according to their karma, and destruction of the pollutants, these three are also the three higher knowledges that the Buddha actualized under the Bodhi tree prior to his awakening. Yeah, so when you read in the Pali canon, the story of the Buddha's awakening and what he meditated on under the Bodhi tree, he gained these three, the last three superknowledges, which are also called the three higher knowledges. Okay, so what are they? Recollection of past lives. You can remember tons of past lives. Second is the divine eye. So you know when living beings pass away and what they're reborn as. This incredible ability. And you can, if you have knowledge of your own past lives, then you will also know which sentient beings you have karmic connections with and what kind of karmic connections with. I think because we've been born everything in samsara, we must have karmic connections with every sentient being. But at certain times, you know, in our lives, certain karmic connections must be stronger. So you would know that, and it helps you benefit those sentient beings. If you know sentient beings passing away and getting reborn, then that you would know kind of what people, if you had disciples, you would know who they were in the past lives, so you would understand them better if they're bringing any remnants of things from past lives into this life. The third one was destructions of the pollutants, so you would know in your own mind and what you've abandoned, and then you would be able to know in other sentient beings who are of the same level or inferior level what they have abandoned. But you cannot know the realizations of people who are in higher levels of abandonment than you are. But just knowing the ones, if you're trying to guide people, it's really helpful. In the Pali tradition, sometimes two other powers are added, okay? So these are knowledge and vision is one, and mind-made body. Okay, so those two are included at the beginning of the list of super knowledges to bring the total to 8. Okay. So the discourse on the fruits of the homeless life, this is in the Digha Nikaya, describes knowledge and vision as follows. The meditator who has attained the fourth dhyana directs and inclines his mind towards knowledge and vision. He knows, this my body is material, made up of the four great elements, born of mother and father, fed on rice and gruel, impermanent, liable to be injured and abraded, broken and destroyed. And this is my consciousness, which is bound to it and dependent on it. Okay, that's the one of knowledge and vision. Yeah, if you understand that, are you going to have strong renunciation of samsara? I bet. Yeah, I mean, you can just see this body is material. It's like this. It's material, atoms and molecules. That's all it is. It's nothing to be clung to. Yeah. This is my body made up of the four great elements. Yeah. Born of mother and father. What did they say that is? Birth is... there was some joke about it. What was it? Both... Do you remember what it is? Let me give me a minute. Anyway, I can't remember it. I'll remember it later, of course. Okay, but fed on rice and gruel, born of mother and father. What's so spectacular about this body? Why do I cling to it? Why do I care about how it looks and what other people think of me and, all this stuff? And what is, it's impermanent. Yeah, aging, which we have no control over. Aging is going to happen whether we like it or not. And liable to be injured, abraded, broken, and destroyed. Yeah, it's perishable, this body, isn't it? Any little thing can, destroy it. And this is my consciousness, which has so much potential, which is bound to this body and dependent on this body. Why is my mind bound to this body and dependent on this body. Yeah. Craving and attachment. Craving and clinging, the eighth and ninth, links in the 12 links of dependent arising. Okay, and then the mind-made body, the second one that the Pali scriptures tradition add to it, is described in the next section. So hold on. Okay. So that would make 8 superknowledges. The Sanskrit tradition asserts that the first 5 superknowledges can be attained on the basis of the actual first dhyana. Yeah, the Pali tradition says that the actual 4th dhyana is required because the mind is very pliant and concentration is strong and imperturbable. Okay. So that's interesting. The description in the Sanskrit tradition was easier than the one in the Pali's. It's usually the opposite. Okay. Now we're going to go through each of the super knowledges individually. First one is called supernormal powers. Yeah. So supernormal powers are super knowledges, but not all super knowledges are supernormal powers. Okay. Sometimes I use the two words interchangeably, but you have to understand that that can be a slip of the tongue. So training for the 5 super knowledges is rigorous, but when the mind is developed in this way, it is able to have mastery over nature and defy ordinary scientific laws. The Buddha described meditators with such power. This is in the Majjhima Nikaya. So having been one, they become many. Having been many, they become one. They appear and vanish. They go unhindered through walls, through enclosures, through mountains, as though through space. They dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. They walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, they travel in space like birds. With their hands, they touch and stroke the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty. They wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. Yeah, which is in the Brahma world, I think, is first dhyana. I think, not certain. Okay, so having been one, they become many. Yeah, they can take their one body and out of it manifest many bodies. Yeah, pretty. So you can be in more than one place at the same time. Ah, I heard of one, I think she was Burmese, in the Tibetan, Theravada tradition. What was her name? Dipama. Okay. And so she's a woman who had some of these powers. And so people reported that they would be on the second floor of the building and look out the window, and they would see Dipama kind of going up. Yeah. And then people would report seeing her at 2 very different places, far apart, at the same time. 2 different people saw her. Yeah. So she clearly had these powers to do that. Yeah. She had died in an interesting way. Because she had incredible faith in the Buddha. When she prostrated, she got down, and then she died. Yeah. So, pretty amazing. Okay, so having been one, they become many. Having been many, they become one. So then they can take their many bodies and zap them together to become one body. Okay. They appear and vanish. So they can make their bodies vanish. They can make them appear and they can make them vanish. Yeah. They go unhindered through walls. This is how Jeffrey got the title of the book, Walking Through Walls. Okay. They go unhindered through walls. Yeah. Through enclosures, through mountains, as though through space. So these 16 arhats, most of them are said to be living in mountains, you know, somewhere, teaching, you know, their whole retinue of disciples until something happens. Remember what it is? Yeah. Okay. But you can pass through mountains, without building a tunnel. Okay. They dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. Okay. They walk on water without sinking. Oh, who else showed that ability? Yeah. And there are stories about there were times in Jesus's early life where there are no records of where he was for how many years was it? Yeah, 16, 12 years, was it? Anyway, some good number of years. And some people speculate that at that time he went to India, and he met some Buddhist yogis. And, you know, he could have learned these abilities, you know, and that's how he was able to walk on water. That's how he was able to, be resurrected. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And what did he do with the bread? Multiply it. And give, he did something with fish, too. What did he do with fish?
Yeah, that was
and
a whole bunch of wine. It was a wedding.
What?
There was a wedding that happened.
Yeah, there was a wedding. And so.
There wasn't enough food.
Oh. Okay, and so he manifested many fish and wine. That part he didn't learn from the Indians, from the Buddhists. Yeah,
yeah. Huge crowd with like 2 loaves of bread and 5 fish, thousands of people.
Uh huh. And then everybody, say it.
I think in the New Testament, there's 2 records of him feeding large crowds. One with, I think, 5 fish and 2 loaves of bread, and one maybe where there's 7 and 3 loaves of bread, but thousands of people. And he just said, break it up and spread it around and hand it out. And it fed the crowd. And he was at a wedding, and they ran out of wine, which back then was just like hard cider. And there were these big jars full of water. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, look again. And they were full of wine. Mm-hmm.
Good wine. Without alcohol. Yeah, so, you know, it's very possible that he, you know, went across the Middle East into India and met with Buddhists or with even some Hindu yogis. There's a video out about that. I remember seeing it long, long time ago. Yeah. Okay. So they dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. They walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, They travel in space like birds. Wow, you don't have to sit on planes for hours upon hours. You know, you can just levitate and zoom over there. Okay. And they could touch and stroke the moon and sun, yeah, without burning their hand or freezing their hand. Okay, they wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. So they could, yeah, do things with sentient beings, even up into doing things with the Brahmins. So people with supernormal powers can make their body into many bodies and then absorb these diverse bodies back into a single body. They can make themselves invisible, vanishing and reappearing at will. They pass through solid materials with ease, walk on water, fly in space, and even touch the sun and moon. Yeah, could Jesus fly in space? Are there any records? Is the resurrection, is he seen as going up or anything? I am illiterate about these things. Okay. Anyway, the path of purification by Buddhaghosa, Pali sage in the 5th century, describes the process to develop these powers, which is done by means of samadhi, developed in a series of preliminary exercises with the kasinas, colored discs or different elements as meditation objects. So remember last time I talked about the kasinas? Yeah, and that they would be your meditation objects. So if it were a color or one of the elements, you know, you would put it on a board and put that in front and then look at it and then close your eyes and visualize it. So with the earth kasina, this is how they develop these, yeah? With the earth kasina as an object, so maybe they would have a bunch of clay, yeah, that you would put on a board in like a circle and then put that up in front and look at that and then visualize, yeah? Okay, so with earth kasina as an object, meditators first attain the first dhyana. Then they attain the first dhyana successfully, one after the other, using the 7 kasinas. So attain the first dhyana with water, then in the water kasina, then the fire kasina, then the air kasina, then the blue kasina, the red kasina, the yellow kasina, and the white kasina. Yeah. So they would attain the first dhyana using all 8 of those objects, you know, one after the other to attain the first dhyana. Then they would do that in the reverse, entering the first dhyana, beginning with a white kasina, then do it, attaining it with the yellow, the red, blue, air, fire, water, and earth kasinas consecutively. Okay, and so they would go attain the first dhyana with that. Then they would come out of the first dhyana, change meditation object to the next kasina, and then again attain the first dhyana. Okay, so that's the first exercise. After that, they enter the first dhyana using each kasina in sequence and reverse orders many times, okay? So using start with the earth kasina, using each kasina in sequence. Yeah, first you do it with one, the other, and the next, and then in the reverse 8 order, okay? Many times, not just once, but you practice. So it's done easily. Then, okay, this is all the preliminaries. Then beginning with the earth kasina, they attain each of the 4 dhyanas and the 4 formless absorptions in succession, in sequence. Okay, from the absorption of neither discrimination nor non-discrimination, which is the peak of samsara, yeah, the highest formless realm. From that, they then descend, absorption by absorption, back down to the first dhyana. So you're at the absorption of neither discrimination or non-discrimination, then you go absorption in nothingness, absorption of infinite consciousness, and absorption in infinite space, yeah, then down to the fourth dhyana, third, you know, and so on. Okay. Yeah, so up and down, still using the earth kasina. Then they practice going in and out of each dhyana very quickly in forward and reverse orders using the earth kasina. In, out, like really fast. Yeah, this is not easy. Yeah. When this has been mastered, they proceed to do the same with each of the seven kasinas in turn, so that they have mastered all eight meditative absorptions with these eight kasinas in forward and reverse orders. Okay? Is this a good antidote to arrogance? Okay, following this, we're still at the preparatory stages. Following this, they alternate the dhyanas. Using the earth kasina, they attain the first dhyana, third, infinite space, nothingness. Then they do this with each of the other seven kasinas going with, you know, like hopscotch. Do one, skip the next, okay? Then they also train so that they can enter the first dhyana with one kasina, the second dhyana with another kasina, the third with yet another, up to the absorption of neither discrimination nor non-discrimination. So you're not only changing your dimension of mind, but you're changing the meditation object. Yeah. Having mastered this, they now go from absorption on neither discrimination nor non-discrimination down to the first dhyana using a different kasina to attain each absorption. Mm-hmm. They develop the ability to go into the first dhyana quickly, stay for a moment, emerge from it, and using another kasina go into the second dhyana, stay in it a moment, emerge from it, and so on up to the absorption of neither discrimination nor non-discrimination, and then back down to the first kasina. So very quickly going in and out of these different dimensions of mind. In this way, they build up amazing mastery of the mind, entering and emerging from deep states of absorption in a few seconds. This preparatory process develops extraordinary mental power, which is then used to direct the mind to the exercise of supernormal powers. Through the force of their intention, and based on this profound acuity and agility in samadhi, they gain the supernormal powers described above. Okay, going through walls, going, multiplying their body, just absorbing them and so forth. Okay, so they do this through the force of their intention. Yeah, they have the intention to do this, and based on this profound acuity and agility in samadhi that they have generated through going through all those preliminaries that I just described. Yeah, which is going to take you some time too. So one of these abilities, you know, in this first one of supernormal powers, is the ability to create a man-made body in which the dhyanic mind creates another physical body that is an exact replica of the meditator's own body with all its limbs and sense faculties. Yeah, so now you have a twin. Yeah, but it's a mind-made body. The Buddha described it as like a reed extracted from a sheath, a sword pulled out of its scabbard, or a snake removed from its sloth, its skin. Yeah, so this body is kind of like, guess, kind of like that appearing from the physical body. Yeah. Once the mind-made body has been extracted from the physical body, the meditator mentally controls it because it has no mind of its own. Yeah. In other words, it isn't like there's two different people with two different streams of consciousness. You know, it's one stream of consciousness that's in the meditator, and that meditator can control the movements and everything in the man-made body. Yeah. Okay, so the meditator mentally controls the man-made body because it has no mind of its own, even though to others it looks as if it is a normal body moved by its own consciousness. So they, you know, we may be somewhere and see somebody and it's actually their man-made body that's talking to us. Yeah. And we just see them as, you know, regular Joe Blow. Yeah. This man-made body can travel to distant places while the meditator remains at the monastery. It can appear to teach Dharma elsewhere, and when it has served its purpose, the meditator absorbs it back into his own body. What is it made out of? Ask somebody who's a man-made body. Okay. So we'll stop here. That's the first of the six superknowledges. Questions, comments?
So I was just thinking about the ability to know everybody's past lives, and I was thinking about a mind that could hold that and be with that even. You know, it seems so, I mean, your mind would have to be so vast.
Yeah.
So vast.
Yeah. Just to remember all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is it true? It seems like in my mind I'm thinking that the Buddha doesn't really have much of an effort to make this or that happen, you know what I mean, or put his mind here or there. Yeah. It just comes.
Yeah.
So then there's that part of it.
Yeah.
With this.
Yeah. Well, with the people below the Buddha, they have to have the intention.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And they direct like the man-made body.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They would direct it. So there's intention going on and there's control. With the Buddha, these things happen spontaneously because of the great accumulation of merit. So and the great habit, you know, that the Buddha's developed in doing all these things through constant, you know, so many eons practicing these different powers.
Mm.
Yeah. And so then it's all done, you know, it's like out of habit.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to think and say, oh, okay, what's so-and-so doing over, you know, it just is there. Yeah. It's amazing to think that our mind has that kind of capability, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
You may not like this question, but I'm curious. We were talking last week or the week
before. Yes, speak directly.
Yeah, we were talking last week or the week before about bodhisattvas being able to emanate by the great level of the path of accumulation. And here, these people don't even need to be on a path. They can be non-Buddhist. Do you think this is the same as emanating if they're making these, they're multiplying their bodies? How's that different from...
I missed you. Do you think they're enemy?
Emanating.
Emanating. Oh, are the man-made bodies the same as emanations? I don't know. Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe not. It could be that the emanations, like with bodhisattvas, you know, first ground bodhisattvas, what is it, 100 emanations or 1,000? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that might be different than a man-made body. Because here they're describing, is just, I don't know, one man-made body. With the emanations, I'm path of seeing like many of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this description that you just read, Venerable, of this capacity building, going in and out of these different kasinas, and then this sentence that says, through the force of their intention and based on this, the agility, they gain these supernatural. So you could be doing this and not have the motivation to be a Buddha, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That, now, of course, their ability to do this isn't going to be as extensive as the Buddha's ability. It's not saying that they manifest bodies throughout
right.
the universe.
Right.
They can manifest one man-made body.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm not even talking about the man-made body right now. I'm just talking about going in and out of these different states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they can do.
And so are they creating merit at this point? Are they doing purification, or is this just mind power?
Well, I think it depends a lot on their motivation. You know, if you're doing it because you want to develop these powers, because you heard that they're around and wouldn't it be cool to have them, or if you are doing, you know, doing these meditations because you want to have the powers so you can teach the Dharma in a way that is more impactful for people.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And the other thing I was wondering about is the ability to see past lives of people. How do you grow the fortitude to be able to withstand seeing all of that?
Yeah. Well, again, the Buddha sees all of the past lives. These people don't. They develop the ability, you know, to see certain numbers of past lives, depending on how much they practice it and generate this ability. But the Buddha's ability to do all these things is much, much greater. Yeah. Okay. So, let's dedicate. Yeah, when you hear about these things, our mind tends to go, oh, you can do them all perfectly. Yeah, they're, you know, oh, I can, you know, go in and out of walls and make my one body become many bodies. Oh, that means, you know, I can have infinite bodies and they're all going in and out of walls and walking on water at the same time and doing all these things. It is, I don't think it's quite like that, you know, because it depends how much somebody has practiced, how they've directed their mind, what their intention was, how they're using these things, yeah. So you don't just like get the power and now it's extensive like the Buddha's, yeah. Okay, there's degrees of learning things. It's kind of like, you know, learning anything, there's stages and degrees, and yeah, you want to be a football star, you don't start out being, you know, a hero and your first practice. Yeah, it's something that is developed over time. Mm-hmm.